Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who met his wife while training for the 400 meters in Seattle and is eating gluten-free while lusting after bread, Dave Denniston.
Hello, my friends. This is Dave Denniston, and welcome back to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. This is a podcast dedicated to helping doctors just like you slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. Oh, well, my friends, I just want to say I've loved connecting with so many of you, the emails and the phone calls and people who have bought my books. I just want to say thank you so, so much for listening to this podcast, spending a busy time out of your compressed schedule to tune in here. And I have to tell you, we now have over 13,000 downloads by the time this podcast comes out. So again, thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening, tuning in. And I just want to encourage you, hey, connect, reach out to me. I love hearing from you. One of the places that I am on is LinkedIn. So if you happen to go to LinkedIn, look for David Denniston, CFA. So I love to connect with my audience. If you go to drfreedompodcast.com, I have my personal Facebook page linked on there on the right-hand bar as well as the LinkedIn. So reach out. Say hey, if you are a physician and you love listening to this podcast. And also, I just want to do a few quick shout-outs here. On iTunes, one of the most important things for the podcast is to get reviews. So I'd like to thank Jeff Wandering, Sexy Nerds Are Us, Janet E. Johnson, Glenn Livingston, TBW3406, Mark McAllister, Jesse, JK, and Jimmer. Every single one of you means so much to get comments like that on the podcast, and I would love to ask each one of you that are listening to do that as well so we can get to know more and more people, get more and more downloads. And here in a moment, my friends, we are going to have a conversation, a fireside chat with a physician. This was a person that I was connected with on LinkedIn, and I think I had wished him a happy birthday or something of that nature, and we started a great conversation between the two of us. And next thing you know, we hop on the phone, or actually it was on the computer, and we recorded the conversation. And this gentleman, he is so special. He is a physician. He is a neurologist who started with the military and had a long career there for about 20 years. Then he moved to private practice, where he had some big pitfalls and things that really caused him to lose a little bit of hair and sleep. And now he's actually looking to start his own practice rather than working for someone else. But in the meantime, he's doing locums full-time. So it's a really great journey. I know you're going to enjoy these stories as much as I did. Altogether, we talked for like 1.5 hours. And so I've cut down the content to try and be as concise as possible while still capturing his journey. So I've cut it down to about an hour. So I'm splitting this up. We're going to do about 30 minutes this week and about 30 minutes next week. And also, I'm not going to have any commercials today, so you can just roll on through it, just because I enjoy this gentleman so much. Out of respect to him and him spending time with me, I want to make sure to honor that. So, with no further ado, here is John McBurney. So, tell me a little bit about your background in medicine. How did you get started? What was that journey like?
Yeah, you know, sometimes I ask myself what the source of my motivation for going into medicine was really. You know, I grew up in a small town in East Central Alabama, Opelika, which is next to Auburn, which is where the university where all the football and all that stuff is.
Yes.
And I was the first person in my family to graduate from college. My parents were smart people, but it was, you know, in an era, as we've been talking about with the political season, where you could certainly make a reasonable middle class living with a limited amount of education. So while my father went to college, he never finished. I think I came along and kind of derailed his educational plans. And I would think growing up in that small town that I just saw physicians as the main exemplars or role models that I would want to emulate. There weren't, I was never around attorneys. I was never around, really successful entrepreneurial class people. In fact, I don't think the word entrepreneur was even in the lexicon back in the 60s. It's certainly not in Opelika, Alabama. But you certainly go to the doctor, and the doctor would be the most powerful, most accomplished person in the community by a wide margin. So I said, well, I want to be like that, and I was a pretty good student, and anyway, I worked my way through Auburn as a nursing assistant or an orderly in the hospital there in my hometown, the same hospital that I was born in fact, now called East Alabama Medical Center. It was called Lee County Hospital back then, and made a lot of contacts with physicians there, came under the influence of some really, really accomplished physicians who were all alumni of Emory University, which was, so Emory was definitely a reach for me when I applied to medical school, but I got in having no idea how I would pay for it, and back then it was pretty easy to get a military scholarship to go to medical school, so I got a health profession scholarship program, full ride scholarship to go to Emory. So I graduated from Emory without any debt, and I graduated from Auburn because I worked my way through without any student loan debt.
Was that uncommon, John? As you were growing up there, was it common just because costs were low enough that you could get away without debt at that time?
Yeah, I think costs were quite a bit lower, especially at a place like Auburn. I think when I started at Auburn, the tuition was a flat fee. It wasn't by hour. And if I remember correctly, and I'm not 100% sure that I do, but I think it was $400 a quarter for tuition. Mm. And books were relatively inexpensive, especially if you bought used books. So, I could make my, minimum wage job and, a few 20s passed from grandparents and my parents when they could help me. I was able somehow to just, make it. I don't understand how it worked, honestly. I think back on it, it seems like if somebody described that that's how they were going to do it, I would describe it as a pretty shaky proposition,
So what do you make of today then, where, we have so many physicians coming out with $200, $250, I mean, literally a mortgage.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's horrible. And in fact, I think that it's one of the real causes or contributors to the epidemic of physician distress and the epidemic of suicides among young physicians, and that they are absolutely trapped. If they get partway in and decide, hey, this isn't really what I thought it was going to be. It isn't what I want to do. They have this gigantic non-dischargeable debt. And I've gotten involved through, MoveOn.org and different organizations to lobby for some, student debt relief at a legislative level. I really think that under some circumstances that student loan debt needs to be forgivable in bankruptcy. If somebody says, I just want to go teach elementary school or I want to go work in a bike shop or, I just need to go just sort of stare at my navel and meditate for a while to preserve what's left of my sanity, they need to be able to make that choice. That would not be an easy choice, but they need to. And, it's really bad for physicians, but it's not unique. I think that Another group that is really getting crushed by debt are veterinarians.
Because they're only making $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 max, maybe.
And yeah, the offshore vet schools that a lot of them are being forced to go to because there just aren't that many slots in the U.S. Are unbelievably expensive. I mean, I've read, you know, things of, you know, graduates from these offshore Caribbean veterinary colleges coming out with $500,000 of debt.
Do you think growing up was, what kind of like attitude did you have about money? Was being debt free something that was important to you, instilled in you growing up? You know, what was that journey of growing up in Alabama like, as you started thinking about money and money decisions?
You know, I think one of the real weaknesses of my upbringing is that there was enough scarcity that money wasn't something that I developed a very significant relationship with, because there just wasn't any. You know, so I definitely went through a period of time where I, and to a degree still, treat money maybe less intelligently than I could or should. You know, but in contrast to a lot of my peers, I think I've been able to, you know, partly because, you know, for 20 years I was in the Army and I wasn't making the big bucks when it was still an era where physicians made, you know, obscene amounts of money. So I sort of avoided that trap.
Now, this is interesting. Let's talk about the Army for a little bit. So I'm following your journey. You start out in Alabama. You're idolizing physicians. You see them as someone that you want to aspire to be. You go to your undergrad. You go to medical school. When does the Army fit into this picture?
Yeah, as a health professions scholarship program or HPSB student, you're kind of owned by the military. So you don't apply for residency through the match. You apply through the military programs. And so it's a completely separate thing. And so I wound up getting selected initially for psychiatry internship at Walter Reed in D.C., and then I switched to neurology about halfway through my internship, and decided I wanted to be a neurologist. Partly just because I'd done an elective at Emory that was really an amazing elective. As a senior student, I had two patients in weekly, 1 hour a week for each of them, insight-oriented psychotherapy as a student. And then I had an hour of supervision with a young psychiatrist who ran the drug and alcohol program at the VA in Decatur, and was himself training to be a psychoanalyst. He would fly up to New York, to Columbia University, to get supervision a couple of times a month. And so I had this experience that was unique. I doubt that there was anywhere in the country that offered, you know, students that kind of latitude. And I would be surprised if they still offer that at Emory, quite honestly. But by the end of that senior year, I was beginning to have doubts that I just wanted to do that for the rest of my life. And so I'd done a lot of neurology as a student, anticipating that a psychiatrist would need to be well-versed in neurology. So I showed up to, Walter Reed and started my internship on neurology. And I knew a lot more than most of the first year neurology residents did. They were just starting their residencies. And so I got a lot of strokes and, yeah, just really kind of had a good time and infuriated the psychiatry department when I flipped. I decommitted and signed with a different team. Anyway, so I did my internship and then my 3 years of residency at Walter Reed. and then was assigned as a solo neurologist in a community hospital at Fort Benning, Georgia, with big training facility, the infantry centers there, the ranger schools there.
Yes. Well, let me just interrupt you there first. Let me just interrupt you for a second. Let me just say, first of all, thank you for your service. I think
I was enduring the great peace. I really was. At the end of my time in the military was the first Persian Gulf War, and we were all expecting the worst, and everybody was shipping out. And
well, I would like to step back for a second. There's something that I didn't capture here. Here you served all this time. I didn't capture why you decided to go for the military. Option, you know, as you were evaluating, like, how did that decision come about?
Yeah, so I was really proud and excited. I'd gotten into Emory. I was horrified at the cost. I made an appointment with a financial aid director at Emory University. I didn't really understand how financial aid worked in that. You know, there was really no financial aid available to me at Auburn. It wasn't that I rejected financial aid. Back then, there just wasn't any. There weren't these federally guaranteed or federal student loans. There weren't Pell Grants. You know, you could either get private sources of loans or you just had to have the money. And so I had no idea how I was going to come up with. I think the tuition at Emory then was a little under $10,000 a year, which sounds like such a joke now. But I was terrified. I had no idea how I was going to be able to do that. I was weighing offers at state schools and where it would have been a lot less expensive. And I met with this guy, and he basically treated me like an interloper. He treated me like a complete unworthy human being because I was even having to, you know, try to understand how financial aid worked. And he just sort of blew me off. And so at the same time, back then, the scholarships are extremely, military scholarships are extremely competitive now. And back then, the military was begging for people to even consider, you know, applying for their programs. And so this Army recruiter just made it super easy. And the next thing I know, I'm all accepted and I get books, tuition, and $400 a month non-taxable stipend.
Because this was at the height of the Vietnam War, I'm guessing.
No, it was after Vietnam. I graduated from Auburn in 77. So I just, you know, I had to register for the draft, but it ended when I was a senior in high school. But there was definitely still the post-Vietnam aftertaste. There was still a lot of very, very strong anti-military sentiment. That was one of the things that I had to confront when I was in medical school, and that most of the, you know, junior faculty for sure were extremely anti-military.
Let me kind of get back to where you were. So you're serving in the military, and tell me about kind of financial decisions. Obviously, most physicians get paid less for being in the military. So how were you thinking? Because you said you served for 20 years. Wow, 2 decades in peacetime, but still, you're serving in the military for 20 years, taking a relative pay cut. You're probably, I'm guessing, moving around the country, maybe the world. How was money kind of coming into play in this journey?
Yeah, so, you know, number one, I made a lot more as a resident than residents typically made in civilian programs. I was a captain. The 4 years I was on reserve status during medical school counted to longevity. So when I started as an intern, I was a captain over 4. We got a 17.3% pay raise from Ronald Reagan. And so in the early 80s, I was making almost $40,000 a year as an intern, which wasn't bad money.
That's great money.
So my wife was working, and we initially rented a little house in Kensington, which is just north of the district. And we got to thinking that we wanted to buy a house. And this was, Paul Volcker was the head of the Fed. The interest rates were, the prime rate was at 1.22% then. We bought a house where the developer bought down the interest rate on our mortgage to a mere 12.9%. So we were house poor, and then we lost a lot of money successively on buying and selling real estate with those moves. We've made,
because you had to, pretty much, right? I mean, you didn't have too much of a choice.
Yeah, there was no we could have continued to rent, and that's probably what we should have done, but we didn't want to do that. You want to have this sense of place, and that's what owning a home gives you, is a sense of belonging, a sense of place. So we bought this townhouse out in Chantilly, which is out near Dulles Airport. We convinced ourselves that the commute wouldn't be bad based on going and looking at it on the weekend, not realizing what a nightmare it would be during rush hour. We paid, an arm and a leg for our mortgage payment. And then partway into that, my wife gets pregnant with our son, and we felt it was really important for her to be able to stay home after he was born. So, we really couldn't afford the house. So we wound up, basically just selling it to get rid of it. So, in contrast to a lot of military people, like in the more combat arms where rotations are really frequent, as a physician in the military, at least back then, you could sort of get to a place and stay there. I was at Madigan for 9 years.
That's a long time in the military. Yeah.
And I got to do a lot of neat things. We started a neurology residency there, so I was involved with the startup of this neurology residency. We built a brand new hospital that was a shell when I got there. We were still in the old World War II era building when I got there, but we got to be involved with designing the build out of the hospital, the equipment, the diagnostic suite for the neurology program, started an epilepsy monitoring unit, a sleep lab. So that's pretty heady stuff. I mean, I 1989, I put in a request to buy equipment to go into our our neurodiagnostic EEG lab, sleep lab, for $500,000. That was a lot of money back then.
Mm-hmm.
So
do you think, so it sounds to me as I'm just listening to you talk, that I'm really hearing you're getting a lot of fulfillment out of helping to build a whole program. And so you're staying around for that reason, as well as I'm sure dedication to the country. And were you ever entertaining at this point the idea of private practice, or were you looking to get to the 20 years for a pension, or what's conflicts are you dealing with inside as you're evaluating financial retirement type decisions down the road?
You don't go in thinking you're going to go for 20, but you go in saying, I want to do this. And you just sort of break it down into bite-sized chunks time-wise. And so the next thing you know, you get beyond some point where you go, gee, what's the annuity value of a military retirement that's 50% of your base pay and has cost of living built in, and it starts paying as soon as you retire in your 40s. It's a lot. Because right now, I make about $45,000 a year in military retirement pay, and I've been getting that for almost 15 years. And we'll continue.
Did you ever think about delaying that? Was there any advantage to delaying that pension?
It's not an option.
Not an option. Okay. So
now you could, if you were in a strong financial position, I suppose, just immediately put that into some other type of investment. But you know, truth be told, we lived on it. You know, what I found was I did do some outside moonlighting type of work when I was in the military, and probably, you know, added about 30-40% to the income that that we received through the military. And one thing I should say as in digression is when you're in the military as a physician, you know, you're not just getting paid what you know, an infantry major makes. There are all these additional pays that you get. And one of the things is that the longer you sign a contract for, the bigger that money is. So that fully 50% of your compensation could be based on these, there's something called a MORB, a medical officer retention bonus. Might wind up being $30,000 or $40,000 a year, depending on your specialty. But that's another way it gets broken down into five-year chunks. You go, well, I really want to take this MORB that they're offering me. And so you wind up just a piece at a time going along. And next thing you know, it's, like I said, I would think the value of that, if you were to just say, if you were going to at age 43 purchase an annuity that started paying you $35,000 a year at age 43 and had cost of living built into it and survivorship for your spouse built into it, how much would that cost?
Yes.
That it would be, probably be at least a couple of $1 million, I would guess.
I would think so. We'd have to crunch the numbers on that. That'd be an interesting exercise that I'm sure you went through.
That becomes the draw. You know, it's just, can I get to 20? And also the lure of, you know, going on to do other things. But I'll tell you, in retrospect, I feel like the best time of my entire career was the time that I was in the military. I dealt with the most honorable and ethical and reasonable people of my entire career. And honestly, I feel like my post-military experience has been a series of almost hostile, abusive encounters. I could tell you some stories that would make your hair curl. You know, I could tell you stories about being in neurology practices where the senior partner routinely took a quarterly bonus of over $200,000 each. A quarterly bonus. So there is no ethical way that a neurologist can make $1 million a year from clinical work. There's no way that you can do that ethically. I had a job where it was in a resort type of area. It seemed like it was going to be like the answer to our dreams. It really had exactly what I thought I wanted. And my wife was also working with me kind of as my assistant. And the first payday came and we didn't get paid. And so I just I said, I'm not going to react to this. It's probably just a mistake. There may have been a problem with the direct deposit routing number. Who knows? So I called the office manager and I say, wasn't today payday? And she started sobbing and confessed that what I'd been told was fraudulent, that the practice was under investigation, that money was disappearing, and that she didn't know where it was, and she couldn't make payroll.
Oh my gosh.
And so, you know, we stuck around for a few more days. We got an attorney to give me some advice. Ultimately resigned without giving notice. And then the next day actually went and sat down with a special investigator for the Attorney General's Office for Medicaid Fraud and gave them a tape account of what I had witnessed for 4 hours. And then had to pick up and figure out what to do after that, again, because of non-competes. And this particular individual was very lawsuit happy. He actually had an attorney on retainer that he paid $5,000 a month retainer just to harass people and intimidate people. So I've seen some really, really bad things. And I think that, you know, physicians coming out of training with debt need to be very, very discerning about what they get themselves mixed up with, because people are, you know, going to any lengths, fair or foul, to try to preserve those big money days of medicine. And I think they're gone. I think that the money's decent. It's not great when you compare it to the opportunity costs and to the debt load that people come out of their education with, but it's better than most folks can aspire to. The lure of when it sounds too good to be true, it's too good to be true.
It probably is. So what do you think in terms of, you have your military experience, John, you got the private practice. Along this path, what has been some of the best financial advice that you got? And from who?
Okay, long pause. I probably from my wife. My wife is very frugal. She doesn't believe in wasting money. Her mother. Her mother and father raised two children successfully on a modest amount of money. My father-in-law was a hairdresser in Atlanta. He was very successful. You know, he wound up, I don't know if you've seen the movie Driving Miss Daisy.
Oh, yes.
He actually did Miss Daisy's hair at a time that these wealthy women would go to the beauty parlor once a week to have their hair done. He did the governor's wife, Frank Saunders' wife's hair. There's a large department store in Atlanta called Rich's. He did Mrs. Rich's hair, and those ladies absolutely loved Mr. Charles, as he was known. And so, you know, but that's, you know, that's definitely, you know, just sort of middle class income. And yet when my mother-in-law died, she had an estate of about $1 million.
Wow.
And that just by pinching pennies, she was able to build up. And I think my wife inherited that from her. So that's the reason that we have any success that we have had.
All right, my friends, this is Dave Denniston. Welcome back to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, don't know if you can tell or not, I am a little bit under the weather, have been having a little bit of sore throat going on, but I wanted to make sure to get this out to you. So we're doing here part two of the conversation with Dr. John McBurney, a neurologist that lives in the state of Oregon. Part one last week really kind of set everything up here, talked about how we got to where he's at right now. And now in part two of the episode, we really get into the financial stuff. So in this podcast today, you're going to learn about his guilty pleasure of cars and what that had meant to their retirement. I'll tell you, he wasn't a popular guy at home for a little while. He also simplified his finances. So he's going to talk about that. You're going to learn about what kind of corporation he was using for locums. You're going to learn about what he promised his kids financially and how that's affecting his retirement. You're also going to discover what kind of practice he will be establishing and the model he is following. And I'll tell you a hint, this involves a past podcast guest. And as part of this is really interesting. He's going to talk about how he's working with different healers and doctors. He then transitions into locums and how he's using locums as a bridge from his last job to his ideal clinic. So, my friends, there's a lot of great financial advice in this part of the podcast as he talks about his financial journey. So I know you're going to love it. So with no further ado, here is the podcast.
So you learned these great lessons from your wife.
Yeah.
If you could boil that down to just two or three lessons, what do you think those were?
Yeah. So avoid debt and don't waste money.
Was there a point you guys ever had? Obviously, you had the houses, and sound like that was a little bit of an issue. Was there ever a point where you had to deal with that? Or you think you got to stay off and stay on the straight and narrow path?
I had a real fixation on cars for a while, and I ran through a bunch of ever escalatingly expensive cars for a while. Had a $70,000 BMW at one point. I was not a very popular guy when I came home with that car. And I eventually had to just wean myself off of the automobile, you know, because unlike a house, which, you know, with a reasonable degree of likelihood can be a decent investment, you know, car, as you've said, I mean, it's just a loss from the minute you start driving it. It's recurring expenses, you know, it depreciates rapidly, you know, and you know, the stereotype of a physician driving a big expensive car is really an ugly stereotype to most people, you know?
Do you think, were you buying into that stereotype? Kind of the reason why you wanted the car, or did you just love cars growing up, or it was a little bit of jealousy, you know, some of your peers making more money at one point? I mean, what do you think was behind this?
Yeah, I don't know why I thought that a new Maxima wasn't good enough and that I needed an M5 BMW. But I, you know, the leather was a lot nicer in the BMW. I don't know. it was a lot more powerful. It was a lot faster. So I was, it was just a sign of immaturity.
Interesting. Well, now today, one of the things I thought was so neat, you and I were conversing back and forth on LinkedIn, is here you are today, you're working towards your own private practice, you're doing locums, you had shared with me earlier before we started recording, and you say now you're living in a small house.
Right.
And you're living in a really great neighborhood in the Pacific Northwest. You have a 10-year-old car, and you use a bike to commute.
Right.
And you don't have any credit card debts. You don't have anything like that. And you're starting your own practice. So that's so exciting to be doing all of those things now in this stage where you are. So congratulations on that. But with all of these things going on, how are you kind of tracking your progress to financial freedom?
I know what our remaining outstanding obligations are. And I know what our bank balance is and what our retirement balance is. You know, I honestly worry about the longer term prospect. I don't know how we can afford this little but very expensive house if I decide at some point to not work. You know, so the Portland real estate market is really, really dynamic. Portland is still not as expensive as Seattle, which I know you're very familiar with. But for most folks in the United States, they would be truly blown away by how expensive Portland is. The thing that Portland has going for it as a real estate investment area is that it's still the least expensive major city on the west coast of North America. I mean, if you start walking down the west coast of North America, starting with Vancouver, British Columbia, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, LA, San Diego, you know, Portland is less than half as expensive as San Francisco, but it's still really expensive. It's still really expensive compared to a lot of places. So, you know, $500,000 doesn't get you much in Portland. Anyway, so what I've done is I've incorporated. I have an LLC. My intent is to file my LLC taxes as an S corp. I'm working with an accountant who has a lot of experience working with physicians doing locums, and we're aiming for pre-tax retirement contributions out of the LLC totaling $51,000 for 2017. We will have our remaining debts, which are our daughter's college loans, the PLUS loans, paid off in about this time next year.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. And yeah, we're very proud of her. She's doing amazing work, but you know, she doesn't make a fortune. And so we basically promised our kids undergraduate college without debt, anywhere they could get in, a car and a savings account. And so that's what they got. And we just finished helping her and also our son buy their first homes. So those are very meaningful things to us. But in any case, I'm going to use my income from doing locums potentially as a bridge to self-finance establishing an integrative and functional neurology micro practice. And the goal of that would be to not have big overhead because it would be a cash-based practice, to really adopt a model. There's a family doctor in Eugene named Pamela Weibel.
Are you Pamela familiar? And I are friends. She's been on the podcast.
Yeah. So it's really very much what she talks about. I'm actually just got an email from a friend of mine who's an internist here, who's got contacts with a chiropractor and an energy healer who has a wellness center. It literally would be to try to do what Pamela did, which is to rent a room on a part-time basis in a wellness center and to slowly try to develop that practice as a part-time endeavor. And as I get busier, to start cutting back on traveling.
I think that sounds like a wonderful plan. And it's one, I think, that for your situation, given some of the things you've experienced, I think you have this pension income that you can count on. You have the locums that you could certainly do as much or as little as you want. And right. I think what's so interesting about Pamela's way of going about creating the ideal medical clinics is having the town hall meetings. Is that something that you've started yet? Or what's that process going to look like? Is that something still a year away? When are you going to hold, or how are you going to get started with that?
Yeah. So my goal is to develop that over the 2017. There's some additional training that I want to do. I'm networking like crazy within sort of the integrative complementary alternative community here. In fact, I have a meeting set up with one of the deans at the Natural College of Naturopathic Medicine on Friday, where I may do a little bit of volunteer teaching as a goodwill gesture and also to further network. And the goal would be to roll this out by the beginning of 2018.
Wow. Good. So about a year away. Yeah. How exciting. Well, it sounds like and I think being in the Pacific Northwest is a fantastic place to do this, by the way.
Yeah.
Just because there's a lot more openness to alternative medicine than perhaps other places. So it sounds like I typically think of neurologists and I think of hanging your own shingle out. is much more difficult usually in today's medical world, because you're usually dependent on referrals from your colleagues in a hospital setting. You know, it's not like Pamela Weibel is a primary care physician. You know, people would come and see her for most anything. In your case, being a specialist, I imagine what you're doing of setting up your own referral network of some other people that are specializing in functional or alternative medicines, like a chiropractor, was probably going to be a great source for you.
Naturopaths, chiropractors, yoga teachers. You know, it's you know, people actually spend more. People in the United States now spend more money out of pocket on complementary and alternative medicine than they spend out of pocket on conventional care. That's how big it is.
I believe it. Well, I think there's so many people. I look at my wife, and I don't know how familiar you've gotten with my story, and having had toxemia, preeclampsia twice, and horrible seizures with the birth of both of our daughters. Our oldest was only 4 pounds, 9 ounces when she came into this world.
Oh, my.
My youngest was only 12.4 ounces.
Oh, my.
And so I know that traditional medicine, in her particular case, to try and do some sort of prevention wasn't helpful for her. And I know, obviously, maybe it's not for everyone, but I think there are certain cases where this can change someone's life by applying a different set of principles. I think physicians, they're trained to cure something when there's a problem there. There's not as much training in prevention.
Oh, there's not. Have you seen the movie, the documentary Escape Fire?
No, never heard of it.
Oh, you really need to watch this. It's Escape Fire, the fight to rescue American healthcare. It was it came out about 3 years ago, and the issues that are raised in it have only become more entrenched and intense since it went out. The I forget the name of the two producers and directors, but they both are previous Academy Award winners. I mean, they tell the story through the voice of people that are involved in this movement, including former head of the Center for Medicare Medicaid Studies, who talks about how, you know, we really don't have a healthcare system, that we are great at emergency care, but we're lousy at everything else. They interview, for example, the head of women's cardiology at Cleveland Clinic, who talks about the insanity of, you know, being able to do a stent and get enormous reimbursement, but to really spend time trying to find out why somebody needs a stent, you don't get paid at all. And so there's got to be a different model. And I think, you know, I think we could potentially be in a kind of a pre-collapse phase for a lot of things in our society, but in particular for healthcare. And, you know, people are going to have to a degree, find their own way. And I think functional medicine for many people is a big part of that. And I would say also, you know, I did the integrative medicine fellowship at the University of Arizona. And what that really is a very much a broadening experience. You know, physicians are very guilty of being very narrowly trained and not knowing what they don't know. And when you go do the integrative medicine fellowship, you get exposed to everything. And so I think that broadening in terms of putting me in a position to be able to access in a respectful and collaborative fashion that community is going to be invaluable. I need to do a little bit more functional medicine training, and I'm actually very excited to figure out how I go about doing that and to go do the Bredesen protocol training. But I think I was explaining it to a friend of mine who's doing functional medicine training, who hasn't done integrated medicine. I said, I think it's sort of like doing the integrated medicine is kind of like getting a master's before you get a PhD. And certainly you can skip the master's and go straight to the PhD, but that you wind up much more narrowly trained.
Well, I think this kind of brings me back home to how physicians, you know, they're so, I mean, physicians, in my opinion, are our best and brightest. And it's so unfortunate how financial training of some sort isn't part of it, whether it's just some sort of how do you run a practice? What should that look like? Some of the lessons that Pamela has been teaching you. So one of my big questions for you, John, is as we wrap up on our conversation is, if you were to talk to a younger you, if you're talking to John that is entering residency, and you're wanting to give him solid financial advice, what would you tell him? What would you talk to John that's a first-year resident about?
Yeah, I would say to try to get ahead of the cash flow curve and live small. You know, when you no longer are having to live on your income, when you're not living, you strive to not live paycheck to paycheck as soon as you can. You know, always have enough of a cushion that that even if you didn't get paid 1 month, it's not going to be the end of the world. And avoid leverage. Absolutely avoid being in debt.
Well, I think that's great advice and great mentorship. And I just thank you for your transparency in our conversation. Sure. It's been really, really great getting to know you. Is there anything that on my end, as someone that does financial education, that you think should be doing more of or less of? You know, what do you think would be helpful to the physician community?
I think just continuing to talk real straight about, in the way that the things that I've looked at through LinkedIn that you've done about, you know, real specific things like only buy a car that you can pay cash for. Mm-hmm. You know, avoid, you know, I mean, the thing that physicians get trapped into is leasing a stinking car as a practice expense. That's just such a stupid thing.
Oh, God, yes.
You know, $700 a month for a $70,000 BMW Uber sedan is just... you know, there's a line in Without Feathers, Woody Allen's book, where it talks about spending money on pear nectar and gold hats. Yeah, so avoid spending money on pear nectar and gold hats, and you'll do fine.
do you have any other closing thoughts, John, to pass on to your brethren and sisters that are physicians as we look at your life and lessons we can learn from you?
Well, the final thing I would close with, especially for physicians in mid or younger career that are starting to feel trapped, is that that you're never truly trapped, and that as we transition through this period of time where reimbursements are going down, 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 and expenses are going up, 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 that locums is a very, very interesting model, and that When a entity, whether it's a practice or a healthcare system, contracts with a locums agency, they understand that there's a cost to that, and that the value that you bring is not necessarily based exclusively on the fees you collect minus your overhead expenses. You know, what I say is, you know, when they go to a locums company, it would be like going to McDonald's and wanting to buy a Big Mac and you only had a dollar. You're not going to get the Big Mac because it doesn't cost a dollar. So with locums, you get paid, and you get paid not based on whether somebody gets a collection and then taking off most of that in overhead. You get paid as an hourly employee, but you get paid really well. And you have a way to control your expenses. And for most physicians, I think they can, if they're willing to do a little bit of traveling, they can recapture a degree of control. You know, most physicians spend, you know, their early evening doing chart work. and answering phone calls. Well, if you're doing that as a locums doctor, you're getting paid.
Yes.
You know, you're getting $200 an hour to stay another couple of hours, which isn't a bad deal. But if it's...
Right.
You know, so I would encourage, you know, people, if they really start to feel like they're just being squeezed, to think outside the box a little bit. Think about locums. Think about, you know, Pamela Weibel's ideal medical practice model, micro practices. Think about completely new paradigms other than just trying to try harder at the same paradigm that's not working. Well, you have to check back in a year to see how it's worked out for me.
Well, life is a journey, and I think what I really appreciate about you and about this conversation we've had is in life, we all make mistakes. And here you are, someone that grew up in a situation where there wasn't a ton of resources.
Right.
And you've turned around in your life, served in our military, which again, thank you so much for your service. You went and set up yourself, I think, financially for the future. During that time, I'm sure there were many times things were tight. But now, years later, you got a perspective that I think is different than many other physicians, having been on both sides of the river, if you will. And so I just want to thank you for serving the community. I'm looking forward to hearing more about this next chapter of your life. And if there's anything that we can be doing to better serve physicians, please let me know. So thank you, John, for your time. Thank you for your transparency, and thank you for being a physician serving the community.